Welcome to this week's Key Voices. I'm Caroline Doherty, bringing you a roundup of the latest education news and an interview with our special guest, Natasha Devon. Firstly, the news headlines this week. The three R's won't be included in a grace period for primary schools, says Ofsted. Ofsted will give schools a transition period to adjust to the new framework and develop their curriculum, but this won't apply to reading, writing and maths. Key Stage 2 interim results. Girls have widened the gender gap. Girls outperformed boys at the expected and higher standard across all tests, and 65% of all pupils met the expected standard nationally. The National Audit Office has released a report that they claim shows a shocking failure of the SEND system. Insufficient funding and stretched council budgets have left pupils without the support they need, says the government's auditor. Also this week, the BBC reported on the findings of the Independent Commission on Examination Malpractice, set up by exam boards to investigate the prevalence of cheating in public exams in England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The report said that overall there is a very low level of malpractice and included among its recommendations a ban on all watches from exams to stop cheating. Ofsted will introduce a new framework for inspecting initial teacher training next year, with an increased focus on how trainees are taught to manage behaviour. The NEHT released a report called Multiple Concerns, calling for multiplication tables tests to be scrapped, with those surveyed saying that the test did not give them any new information about children's abilities. Now on to our interview series. Natasha Devon, MBE. Welcome, Natasha.
Thank you.
Natasha is an author, speaker and campaigner, and we're going to talk a little bit about mental health in schools. So, on to our interview series. We often hear that it's getting harder to be a young person in our complex and ever-changing world, Natasha, and I'm really interested to know more about the research that you've been doing into to what pupils are most worried about, and also where that is different to their parents and what and the things that the media actually think that young people are worried about.
It's really interesting. The research that I do, I ask young people to list the things that cause them stress and anxiety in order and try and quantify it. So if you have 100% available, what percentage would you say this thing is? And then I ask their parents to do exactly the same activity, and you get exactly the same list, but flipped on its head. So young people will start always with academic anxiety and exam stress and time management, things like homework and stuff like that. And then about seventh or eighth, they'll put social media and their parents always put social media at the top.
Right.
And it's because that's the only thing that they can think of that has radically changed. And they think, well, I did homework, I had exams. And what they're not taking into account is, first of all, the kind of changes to the education system that mean that everything you do throughout the academic year is pointing at that exam.
Yeah.
So the sort of importance that is placed on it, but also the way that worries about the future have been magnified. You know, even I sometimes, when I'm feeling nostalgic, I ask my mum to tell me stories about the 80s and how, you know, you just left school and got a job. And if you didn't like that job, you found another one and didn't even have to be a particularly impressive job, and you could get a mortgage and a car.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you didn't have that worry of how will I support myself, how will I sustain myself. So you put those two things together, and then it crystallizes in what they call exam stress, but actually it's more stress about life generally. Yeah. I think
and what do you think can be done to sort of bridge that gap and parents have more of an understanding of what's affecting their children?
I think parents should genuinely listen. So what parents tend to do, and I understand why they do this, is their child tells them something, and all humans do this. We immediately relate it to our own experience. And we think, what have I been through that's a little bit like that? And then through that prism, we try and understand what the other person is saying to us. But particularly if you're a teenager and you're going through a lot of these things for the first time in a way that feels very unique and overwhelming, that sounds or can sound very patronizing. So sometimes it's useful to say, you know, I went through something similar, but you should avoid saying things like, I know exactly how you feel, because you don't ever know exactly how someone feels. And the thing that kept being saying to me when I was going through my mental health training, I had a fantastic trainer called Lee Loveless.
Ooh,
brilliant name.
Great name.
Yeah. And he would always say, you can only ever deal with the person in front of you. So don't try and diagnose. Don't try and tie it up with a bow. Just listen to what they're saying to you. And however distressed they are about it, try and deal with the feeling, not your judgment of how they should feel about that thing. So if somebody's devastated that their rabbit has died, deal with the devastation, not your judgment on the value of a rabbit.
Yeah, for sure. That's some really good advice. So we've been thinking that they're just there a little bit about young people's mental health, and you campaign on a lot of different issues around mental health, particularly mental health at work. And given that we have an audience of school leaders, and we know from organisations like Education Support Partnership that a lot of education professionals suffer from mental health issues. Your Where's Your Head At campaign, you're urging employers to take more responsibility around staff mental health. So what would you say to school leaders, a lot of whom might have their own mental health issues, about what they can do to support staff?
Well, just to give you a little bit of background on Where's Your Head At, we launched that in 2018. And initially it had a very simple ask, and it was that mental health first aid and physical health first aid be given parity within the law. At the moment, there is an obligation. If your business is above a certain size, you have to have provision for physical health first aid within the workplace. And we wanted to just make that equal. Bearing in mind, the government has been promising us parity of esteem, this like fabulously vague phrase, since 2011. We thought that that was a really simple way that they could demonstrate that they meant it. So we collected more than 200,000 signatures on a change.org petition. We got an open letter to Theresa May, which was signed by the CEOs of WH Smith, Thames Water, Lord Sugar, Kelly Hoppen, you know, massive business names. And we also got cross-party support from MPs of all stripes. I think the only party that didn't lend their support in any form was UKIP, and sod them, that's fine. So we got all of this, and eventually a debate was secured in Parliament in January of this year. And the government's official response was, there are lots of employers who are doing more than just mental health first aid. And if we make mental health first aid mandatory, those employers will think that's all they have to do. So they'll strip back everything else and it will become a flaw. So we think that mental health first aid should be part of a range of different interventions that employers offer on a voluntary basis, which is such a government-y politics nonsense argument. And it creates a situation where what you're saying is, it's okay for some people to have a lot of support and some people to have nothing whatsoever. Because at least making mental health first aid mandatory would introduce some equality. They weren't interested in that. So I was very angry for about a week. And then I thought, I need to challenge this this anger into something. So we, in response to that, myself, Bauer Media and Mental Health First Aid, who co-created this campaign, we came up with a manifesto for workplaces with everything on it that we think that businesses should be doing in order to create a mental health friendly workplace. And we are asking employers to sign up to it, employees to look at it and wave it under their bosses' noses, and also local MPs to lend their support to it. And you can find that at wheresyourheadat.org. Now, the school is a kind of uniquely challenging environment, I would say, because you are dealing with young, often vulnerable people who you are invested in. And to be blunt about it, people often take the piss out of teachers because it's disproportionately populated, that profession, with people who care deeply and want to make a difference. And that caring is often translated into unpaid overtime, having to do things which don't fall within the remit of your job. And I think the best thing that school leaders can do is to introduce really stringent cultural, not rules exactly, but just things that everyone does that safeguard mental health. Like, for example, if you can, get your teachers off site during lunch. So if you're not on duty, Don't sit in the staff room during your lunch hour. You know, go create a culture where that's not what teachers do. They don't go to the staff room. They don't mark. They go somewhere and get some fresh air, ideally. Mm. Also, in some of the schools that I visit, they have a rule where you don't send emails to colleagues before a certain time in the morning or after a certain time at night.
Yeah.
I would also say, you know, that about 90% of, particularly in the primary sector, about 90% of teachers are women. Mm. And being flexible about things like maternity leave and childcare, doing everything you can to create an environment where people feel understood, noticed, and supported, that's going to improve the mental health of your staff. And in turn, that will improve the mental health of pupils, because we know that stress cascades down.
And have you got any sort of particular suggestions for staff who are looking after young people who have mental health issues, and as you say, they get caught up in their issues and sort of need support or supervision themselves as a kind of release from that?
I would say that most important thing is to understand where your role begins and ends. It wouldn't matter if you were a trained counsellor. You cannot practice on your pupils. This is widely acknowledged that, you know, if you have a counsellor, they make you sign a piece of paper and it says things on it like, if you don't turn up, I'm still going to charge you. And one of the things it says on it is, if I see you out of context, so let's say we bump into each other at the supermarket, I will acknowledge you, but we can't get into it. We can't have a chat, because if I understand you in context or you understand me in context, it's going to interfere with my ability to do my job effectively because I'm your counsellor, I'm not your friend. Mm. If you are someone's parent or sibling or friend or teacher or colleague, a counsellor is not a role that you can fulfil. Mm-hmm. Having said that, you can be incredibly helpful. And if you think of it as in three tiers, you've got what's often called prevention. I prefer to call it promotion. So it's promotion of good mental health. Then you've got the top tier, which is the one that teachers and parents should never be in, which is the professional, therapeutic or medical care for mental illness. And then the middle tier is your mental health first aid. So it's spotting the early symptoms and having a non-judgmental conversation and signposting that young person, if appropriate, to get the further help that they require. As a teacher, you are in tiers one and two. You should never be expected to go into tier three. And if you have done tiers one and two to the best of your ability, that's all you can do.
Yeah.
And this is something that I learned because, you know, I'm very aware my job is going into schools and conducting research, but also delivering talks on mental health to teenagers. And I'm super aware I've got 1 hour of their entire academic career.
Yeah.
And my job is to just get them thinking a bit differently about it, maybe start a dialogue, you know, and I very much see myself as I go in and then I pass the baton to their teachers and parents. But that means I can't have an off day because it's just another day for me, but it's the only time they'll ever see me. And so I felt this massive responsibility and I was investing. Every time I was going in, I was investing and I was trying to notice every pupil and go, do they get it? You know, have they taken something away from this? And I wasn't able to close that school door behind me and shake it off. I was wondering about them and I took them with me. And eventually that took its toll on my mental health. So as long as you can say, I've done a good job, you have to close the school door behind you. And it's not selfish to go, right, it's my time now. So if you're mentally strong, you're better able to support others.
Thank you. That's really clear. And, you know, we've seen over the last few years that there has been more acknowledgement of the role that schools play in supporting mental health and more responsibility put on schools, frankly. There's been some additional funding from government, but what more do you think needs to be done to make sure that there is adequate provision and that it's evenly spread?
The more that needs to be done has nothing to do with schools, I don't think. I mean, I would redesign the curriculum for all kinds of reasons. I don't think it's fit for purpose anymore. And I would have acknowledgement of mental health, not necessarily mental illness, but mental health at all levels of education, because it's relevant to absolutely everything. But that's not something that is feasible right now. I think in the current climate, given what we have, schools are already doing as much as they possibly can. What they don't have is support within the wider community.
No.
So we've seen children and adolescent mental health services, social services, educational psychologists, school yeah. counsellors, school nurses, all have been really dramatically slashed under austerity and have never really recovered. And one, again, really simple thing that the government could do is ring fence the investments that they're apparently putting into children and young people's mental health.
Mm.
But, you know, the reason that they say that they won't do that is this is exactly the same argument as the argument about where's your head at, but reversed. So they say, well, there might be some local authorities who want to spend more than that on children's mental health. And if we ring fence it, it will become a ceiling. They're obsessed with ceilings and floors, these people. So that's, but you know, we know that in 50% of cases, your average local authority hasn't spent any more on mental health since 2010. So despite all of these apparent investments that the government are putting in, they're receiving the money, we're told, by central government, but it's not reaching the people who need it on the ground. So I think ring fencing that money would be a sensible first step.
Thank you. And finally, we like to end our podcast on a piece of knowledge to act. And I notice your talk at this year's Festival of Education was about three things a school can do around mental health. So if you could give our listeners some detail about what those are, that would be great.
So there are three things that I think all children and young people need to improve their mental fitness. It's not going to cure mental illness, but it will, in just the same way as physical fitness, you know, it will improve their ability to bounce back from mental health issues and perhaps prevent them from arising in the first place. The first is critical thinking. And this is actually because of social media. As much as young people don't tend to think it's a problem, it's because they were born into a world where it was already there. So
yeah.
It's like me saying to you, what effect do you think that television has had on your mental health? You'd be like, I don't know. It's just always been there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So as much as I think social media can be a huge force for good and a way for young people to access information that might be helpful to their mental health, they also have to recognize that it's not free.
Mm.
It's being sponsored by people who have a vested interest in magnifying their insecurities in order to extract money from them, or clicks, because clicks are the new currency. So as soon as they step into the online sphere, they are being bombarded with messages which are effectively designed to cause anxiety-inducing emotions, outrage, confusion, and also to lower their self-esteem, to actively lower their self-esteem. So I'm trying to get to a point where automatically children and young people are asking themselves questions like, what's the agenda?
Yeah.
Where's this come from? Do I agree with this? Is this helping me to be the sort of person that I want to be? And also not to divide their world into heroes and villains.
So
we teach children from a really early age that there are good people and bad people. And nobody is 100% good either. But we have this culture that has arisen largely because of social media, where somebody's either on a pedestal and then they do one thing that's morally questionable and it's like, right, they're cancelled.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're evil. And that's not how the world works. You're meant to extract the good bits from your predecessors and see them within the context of their own cultural moment. And that is one of the reasons why I co-present a podcast called Fact or Bull. And it's exactly that. It's trying to explore the nuance.
The nuance there in debate and public discussion.
Yeah. So I co-present it with a guy called Dr. Keon West, who's a social psychologist at Goldsmiths. A reader. He would want me to say he's a reader. And
I find that such a weird term.
We all read. It means something apparently. But you know, we all need to learn how to decipher a headline, to look at a study and know the value. You know, what was the sample size? Was it peer reviewed? Where has this come from? And even simple things like which part of this is in quotation marks, because that's a direct quote, and then which is just conjecture by the person who wrote it. So teaching those skills, I think, helps to safeguard their mental health in lots of different ways, and also has value for not allowing them to be radicalized as well. And the way that I do it, and I think it's really effective in a school environment, is getting them to take the piss out of adverts, essentially. Oh. So you can get them to bring in their own examples. You can show them in form time. It takes 10 minutes, and it's funny and it's fun. And you're just building that critical thinking muscle. So that's just the first
one. That's just number one.
Yeah. The second one is healthy coping for stress. So giving young people access to things that we know have a therapeutic value. And those broadly fall into three categories. The first is physical activity. Mm. The second is relaxation. And the third is creativity. These are all endorphin producing, and endorphins kind of restore your chemical balance. So looking at your school and going, are there any opportunities for us to increase the access that pupils have to that? So for example, there are some schools that are now doing the morning mile, where we all go for a walk or a jog or whatever for a mile in the morning. So it's not PE, it's just something that everyone does. Can you do some, there's one school that I go into, it's a primary school, and they've rebranded yoga. I think they've called it warrior pose or something, but basically just to make it attractive to boys.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So they're doing that in break time.
Yeah.
Things like that. And then the third is emotional literacy. I tend to think actually that young people are very good at this now. Mm. They tend to have a vocabulary for how they're feeling and are able to convey it quite well. But for some pupils, for whatever reason, they can't explain in words to you how they feel. And they need to be heard and understood in another way. You know, are you allowing them to do that? So a really simple example, some of the classrooms that I go into, they've got emojis on the wall. Everything from I'm ecstatically happy to I'm really miserable and everything in between. And they give each pupil a post-it. And as they walk in, all they have to do, just anonymously, put their post-it next to the emoji that best sums up how they feel at that moment. Mm-hmm. That means when the teacher walks in, they've got a snapshot of where their class are. And it's also teaching them to assess and teaching them that emotions aren't forever. So, you know, yesterday I was at the bottom, but today I actually feel better. So if I do feel really distressed, that's not a life sentence.
Mm. And also seeing that other people are feeling that same way.
Yeah.
And functioning and yeah, that.
Exactly.
Wow. I think that, I can just imagine that being really, really useful to teachers. Well, thank you for those really, really practical tips there. And thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of The Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.